It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Deadly plane crashes in Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia last week brought aviation safety into the national spotlight.
Since then, non-fatal safety incidents have gotten some extra attention, including a ground collision between a taxiing Air Wisconsin plane and an employee shuttle bus at O'Hare International Airport in Chicago on Friday.
This comes as Air Wisconsin announced plans to lay off hundreds of workers, and the Trump administration instituted a hiring freeze in the Federal Aviation Administration and the National Transportation Safety Board.
We're catching up now on what all this means for travelers in and around Wisconsin. Howard Hardy is an aviation reporter for FlightGlobal.com and Flight International Magazine. He previously worked for Wisconsin Watch. Howard, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
As an aviation reporter looking at this deadly crash in the nation's capital, military helicopter. What are some of the big open questions that you're still waiting for answers on?
A lot of the aircraft wreckage is still being pulled out of the river, so we're still pretty early on in the investigation. There, at this point, much of the investigation is focused on the situational awareness of the pilots involved. We know that both aircraft were alerted to each other's proximity by automated systems, as well as air traffic control. We also know that the CRJ pitched up just before the collision, so it does seem as if the CRJ pilots saw the Black Hawk at the last moment and tried to react. We also more recently established that the collision occurred at an altitude of about 300 feet, which is significant because the helicopter was flying in a corridor along the Potomac River where aircraft are prohibited from exceeding 200 feet. So the helicopter was supposed to fly under the regional jet and did not. At this point, it's unclear why the helicopter was at that particular point in space at that time. And that is going to be a main focus of the investigation moving forward.
Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin is on the Senate committee that oversees the FAA and the Transportation Department. She told WISN-TV's Upfront that she thinks the Senate doesn't need to investigate at this point. They should defer to the National Transportation Safety Board for its investigation. Here's a listen.
I don't think that the committee has the expertise that the National Transportation Safety Board has. And so I think that we should wait for their investigation.
What goes into an NTSB investigation like this?
Well, a really critical component is recovering the flight recorders from both aircraft, which has happened before they even pulled aircraft wreckage out of the river. Apparently, the wreckage was pretty close to not a very deep part of the river. But before that wreckage even started coming out of the river, they located and pulled up the flight recorder data. And that does take some time to sort through that data and kind of reconstruct where both aircraft were at what time, what the pilots were saying in the cockpits of both aircraft, and what inputs they were receiving, what warnings that they heard in the moments before the collision, and what ATC was telling them leading up to the accident.
Now, the new Federal Transportation Secretary, Sean Duffy, former Wisconsin congressman, in an interview on CNN, he tried to assure Americans that it's still safe to fly in the U.S.
Of course it's safe to fly. So if you look at the American airspace, we have the safest airspace in the world. And air travel is the safest form of travel that you can undertake in the country. Now, we've seen some cracks, and it rattles people when they see these disasters, but air travel is safe.
I remember back in the day, Howard, 70s, 80s, 90s, passenger air crashes weren't routine. It felt like they were way more common than they are now, and I think the numbers back that up. Can you talk a little more about what Secretary Duffy had to say about overall safety of air travel?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd say that flying commercially in the U.S. has been really safe for the past 16 years or so. The last fatal accident involving a U.S. airline occurred in 2009. That was a Colgan Air -8 that crashed on approach to Buffalo, New York. So the accident in D.C. really disrupts a decade and a half of relatively smooth flying. I know some passengers might not feel that way, given their experience flying with U.S. airlines and going through busy airport hubs and all the cancellations and delays that come with that. But this accident in DC really has already become a defining event for the aerospace industry, and not to mention the families and friends of the people lost in the accident.
There have been concerns the FAA dealing with some air traffic controller shortages, I understand, for years now. Now, the Trump administration issuing executive orders over hiring in the agency, stopping or freezing at some moments. Things change from moment to moment, it seems like. How much of a concern is there on that air traffic, crash investigator side of things when it comes to just sheer staffing levels?
Yeah, that's a big concern. The FAA has acknowledged that it doesn't have enough air traffic controllers to staff its towers. This is particularly a problem in the Northeast USA, where we have super complex airspace around hubs in New York and DC and Boston. And you're probably aware there have been several close calls that have added to this perception that we're kind of building toward a catastrophic accident like the one that we had on the 29th of January. That is not to say that ATC is to blame for the recent accident. Again, we're really early on in the investigation, but absolutely the system is strained. ATC workers are overworked and burned out and managing huge workloads.
We're talking to Howard Hardy, aviation reporter for FlightGlobal.com and Flight International Magazine, about airline safety and an issue here in Wisconsin. I mentioned earlier, Howard, Air Wisconsin seeing some layoffs. You've written about this. What's going on there?
Yeah, I do cover regional air aviation in the U.S. and Canada, and regarding Air Wisconsin and American Airlines, it's sort of unclear what is exactly behind the parting of ways here. Airlines are pretty tight-lipped about this type of stuff. From the outside, it does seem like there are some financial issues. Air Wisconsin is laying off hundreds of employees, and more than 20 of their jets are parked right now, not flying passengers, and neither of those signs are good, obviously. Based on what I'm hearing from American and some broader industry trends that we've observed, American's contract with Air Wisconsin seems to be expiring because American is favoring larger regional jets moving forward. So Air Wisconsin operates a fleet of about 60 CRJ-200s, and those are regional jets that seat about 50 people. And that is an increasingly rare size of aircraft to fly in the U.S. I asked American why they are letting their contract with Air Wisconsin expire in April, and they basically said that they're evaluating operating that size of aircraft across their entire fleet. So American seems to be moving away from that smaller aircraft in favor of larger jets, such as the Embraer 175. And unfortunately, it seems as if Air Wisconsin is a casualty of this decision by American and also this broader trend among U.S. carriers to fly bigger planes.
And I think these regional airlines, Howard, are a little invisible to the public. You go online, you probably don't buy a ticket for Air Wisconsin. You buy a ticket for American Airlines. And that right. one connecting flight, well, it might be subbed out to Air Wisconsin. How big a part of our airline industry are these, in some cases, invisible regional carriers?
Yeah, really big part. I mean, there are thousands of regional jets in operation. And from the perspective of the big network carriers like American and Delta and United, they're really critical components of their networks. They operate these feeder routes that, you know, they're really vehicles for feeding passengers into, you know, major airline networks, which are designed to flow people through big airport hubs and to points beyond, you know, international destinations where, you know, they make a lot of money on those international airfares. Now, in the case of Air Wisconsin, they are an independently owned company. So they're not a subsidiary of any of the big three network carriers, American, Delta, or United. And they struck a deal to fly for American under the American Eagle brand name in the first half of 2023. That's part of the confusion with regional jets, is that it won't actually say the name of their company on the side of the aircraft. It'll say American Eagle or United Express or Delta Connection. So you're right, they're kind of these invisible companies, but they are operating thousands of jets across the U.S., and it's a very important part of the whole system.
So Air Wisconsin losing this contract, apparently, with American Airlines, laying off staff, managerial and otherwise. What are they saying about their future and how they're going to replace this, what sounds like their bread and butter?
Yeah, the company says that it is exploring charter services moving forward, and there are profits to be made in flying, collegiate sports teams around the country, for instance. That's a model that has been replicated elsewhere. It is also saying that it will pivot to essential air service flying, which is federally subsidized flying to rural and underconnected communities. Right now, the future of EAS flying is unclear right now. There is some talk at the congressional level of cutting overflight fees. Those are charged to airlines that fly over the US but don't land here. And those fees partially fund that subsidized flying. So the program, could potentially contract or go away entirely. So I'd say it's kind of unclear how Air Wisconsin moves forward from here. The airline says that it's going to release more details of its new strategy within the next several weeks. So I suppose the airline geeks among us will have to stay tuned.
Well, and briefly, Howard, just in our last half a minute or so, if that funding ends, could we see more smaller airports, especially those serving rural areas, go away or cut passenger service?
Absolutely. That's already happening across the country. In the post-pandemic landscape, regional airlines have been contracting their networks across the country. Part of that is due to a pilot shortage, and another part of that is kind of what I was alluding to earlier, where a lot of these regional carriers are moving increasingly towards large jets, and it just doesn't pencil out to land a 90-seat jet in, a very small community, that it's hard to make money on those routes. So, yes, moving forward, I would expect to see an even greater loss of regional air service in Wisconsin and the Midwest and the US as a whole.
Howard, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Howard Hardy, aviation reporter for FlightGlobal.com and Flight International Magazine, formerly with Wisconsin Watch, with us today to talk about safety concerns in the aviation industry following the deadly crash in Washington, D.C., and some other airline trends affecting us here in Wisconsin. Clarification, that vehicle collision at O'Hare with an Air Wisconsin plane occurred Saturday evening, not Friday.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, artificial intelligence is being used by mental health care providers in Wisconsin to increase access and improve outcomes.
AI, I think, could play a very vital role in terms of how do we get people access to treatment in different modalities that they didn't have before.
The present and the future of AI and mental health, that's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Across the nation, artificial intelligence has entered mental health care.
You may already know about therapy chatbots or scheduling assistants, but how is AI becoming a part of treatment and care?
We talked to two Wisconsin healthcare professionals about AI and mental health care, the benefits and the challenges.
Brian Kay is Chief Strategy Officer for Rogers Behavioral Health, a not-for-profit independent provider of specialized mental health and addiction treatment based in Oconomowoc, and Heather Hessel, a licensed therapist and an assistant professor in the Department of Counseling, Rehabilitation, and Human Services at UW-Stout. WPR's Lee Rayburn spoke to them last week.
Heather, before you had a career as a therapist, you had a career in information technology or IT, so you'd be the perfect person to ask when we're talking about artificial intelligence when it comes to healthcare. Take us under the hood a little bit and explain what this artificial intelligence actually is doing.
As I've been trying to get a handle on all of this, I've kind of settled on thinking of AI integration into therapy as part of a continuum. So there are three layers I think about with this, with some important distinctions for each of those layers. So first of all, therapists already use technology. We've been using it for years to help with things like session notes or contact with insurance companies, that sort of thing. And of course, those need to be in secure and HIPAA compliant systems. And AI can help automate some of those tasks. So that first layer, I really think of as automation. Clients never see that, but it can be really helpful to therapists. The second layer, that next layer of integration, goes further. So it can continue to help with automation, but it actually extends support to therapists in other ways too. But there's a leap in the second layer that's really important ethically. So if therapists share the actual content of a session with an AI system, so that could be video, audio, it could be a transcription, then they can get even more advanced automation support, like it could write the note for them and they could review it and sign it and whatever. But for me, as an educator, I'm most interested in that layer because it can improve our work as therapists. So it can help us grow as therapists by providing feedback and ideas from an AI system. And then finally, there are these client-facing systems. So these are systems that provide direct support to a client. These are the ones the client would see. So they could be apps that a client launches. It could be a chatbot online, or even I'm learning about biometric markers that are captured through smart devices that could then alert the client or the therapist to a potential upcoming crisis. Sometimes a therapist might use one of those apps to augment what they're doing in session, such as, you know, providing parenting support or that kind of thing. But it's this third layer of integration that is really powerful, and if it works well, but there's some definite ethical considerations all along the way too. So I hope that makes sense as
certainly.
I laid that out.
And certainly because of its power, it would need to be investigated further. So automation, support for therapists, and direct support for clients. Brian Kay at Rogers Behavioral Health, how are you integrating artificial intelligence there?
So at Rogers, we've got AI in a couple of different areas. Our most recent area has AI actually on our website to assist individuals who may not be comfortable on calling on the phone to do their first contact with the system. I want to be abundantly clear that AI is not replacing a clinician in any sense in this scenario, but it's a way of having a conversational and very compassionate conversation with the patient, of gathering some information so that we could bring a human in the loop and they're able to complete that screening when they're seeking care. We've partnered with a company out of England called Limbic to do this, and they have a wealth of evidence behind their algorithm. And what they actually found is in certain demographics, it increased people's ability to reach out to seek behavioral health treatment where they might not have been able to do otherwise. So that's been an important piece. And then in the clinical realm, we have AI employed in what they call ambient listening. So ambient listening, we've got two different pilots that are going on across our system, one with providers and the other with therapists, where they have a special phone app and the patient can sense of being able to be recorded through their session. And similar to what Heather was saying, it helps generate a note based on the conversation. And then they're able to review the note, attest to the note, sign off the note, and then it integrates into our medical record. The feedback from our clinicians have actually been extremely positive. They find that it's a way that they could spend more time with our patients because they're not documenting robustly or a ton of time afterwards. It's capturing everything in the moment. And then from the patient side, it has our clinicians be a little bit more, I would say, directive in their conversation. So that's different pieces that the AI has to pick up on, and they feel like it's a bit more transparent in that sense. So AI has been a great enabler in that way. And then finally, we're applying AI algorithms in many different ways to understand different patterns in our patient data. The one thing we got to keep in mind, AI isn't very, very new. A lot of people associate AI right now with generative AI, such as ChatGPT.
Right.
But if you actually look at the underpinnings, it goes back to the 1950s with Alan Turing. So artificial intelligence has been applied to data sets to understand different patterns that humans may not be able to pick out. So we found different ways of understanding who may be at risk of potentially suicide, who would respond to different treatments differently by leveraging large different data sets so we could have more tailored interventions to people.
Yeah, Brian, Rogers had previously used an AI program to help predict the risk of suicide in adult inpatients. What did you find with that program?
So it was a fascinating collaboration that we had with Cerner. And, you know, what we found was some different factors that didn't typically come up in traditional means. So there were some different behavioral factors that we were able to identify. One of actually the largest factors was sleep disturbance. So when we applied AI on our data sets, that was one of the things that kept on popping up. So we actually changed our inpatient treatment programming to have more of a sleep module in there, just because it was so highly correlated with it. We're continuing to find different ways of how do we leverage AI to tackle this problem. It's immensely complex. Yeah. And I foresee AI being a way to help integrate, again, to find those different patterns in data so we can have better interventions for patients.
I've heard the stories anecdotally, certainly, of the struggle to find access to mental health care in Wisconsin. And Brian, from your perspective, how can AI help aid people seeking mental health care in getting that care?
You are absolutely correct. You know, unfortunately, in Wisconsin, the latest I heard, the average wait time to see an outpatient provider for psychiatry is around 60 days. So when someone has behavioral health needs, you know, it's very, very difficult to get treatment. We at Rogers have been finding ways of expanding our continuum. We're actually all over the state at this point. So we're trying to help fulfill that need. But as I was mentioning earlier, AI, I think, could play a very vital role in terms of how do we get people access to treatment in different modalities that they didn't have before. The Limbic program is just providing one additional access point where people haven't had before. And I think, you know, for different providers across the state, we got to understand what the consumer needs are and how do we provide tools to them that they would be able to easily access treatment and get over that hump.
We're talking about AI in Wisconsin's mental health care space with Brian Kay, the Chief Strategy Officer for Rogers Behavioral Health, with a location in Oconomowoc, and Heather Hessel, a licensed therapist and assistant professor at UW-Stout. And Brian, should patients be concerned about their data and artificial intelligence? Can it be shared or sold? Is it secure?
Well, I will speak from the Rogers side of things. Everything is completely secure. So to what Heather was saying, there's an extraordinary amount of care that goes into working with patient data. And anybody who does work with that has to understand that every patient's story is within that data. So we take extraordinary protections to ensure that it's walled off within our system, ensuring that the data isn't leaving, going to outside providers or being sold in that sense. And then the other piece that we do is when AI is being utilized, we want the patient to know that that's the case. As we were speaking about Limbic on our system, it self-identifies that, hey, I am an assistant powered by artificial intelligence that's going to help out. So being able to show that this is how it's augmented in the process is extraordinarily important. And then anything from an algorithmic development that we have done, we have actually put through an institutional review board to ensure that ethics are considered through it, that privacy is considered through it, and that we have all the data protections and safeguards. One interesting aspect to touch on, AI is also going to be extremely crucial of protecting data. In the healthcare sector, there has been such an increase of cybersecurity attacks. The stat I believe I heard was close to 400% year over year. The ability to implement systems to help protect data that are based in AI is also going to be a crucial piece. So it's kind of an interesting catch-22. AI is going to protect data, but also we've got to be able to have be the ones that build those safeguards so that the data is protected from AI.
Heather, there are a number of therapeutic chatbots where people can go online to talk to an AI program, and there's some life coaching available, counseling, even therapy. What's your position on therapeutic chatbots as they exist right now?
I definitely think that therapists need to be in the driver's seat. I believe there's a huge role for AI in helping to train therapists and in helping therapists grow. So I'm really focused in my work on that second level of integration. I don't think therapists will get replaced. I appreciate Brian saying that right up front. And I do think chatbots can present a level of risk that we need to be really careful and cautious about.
Brian, another research area of mental health that Rogers works with is in addiction, and you have some research underway now for assessing opioid addiction risk using artificial intelligence. Where do you see some of these opportunities for AI and addiction?
You know, again, it's the application of AI to understand different patterns within the data. Interestingly, so that's some of my dissertation work that I did. So I'm very, very familiar with that algorithm. And, you know, what we found were some different patterns of how can we intervene at the end of treatment to inhibit readmission to higher levels of care. You know, you find these little signals in data that may not be very, very prominent, but AI is able to pick it up because it's so good at pattern recognition. So we're applying it in those different ways of ensuring that we could get people out to care and get them back to their lives and finding ways to safeguard them from coming back to treatment by getting the right interventions up front.
Heather Hessel, what are some of the unusual ways that we're seeing AI used in mental health care, and how are you seeing it applied in your classrooms?
I'm glad that you asked about the classrooms. We're just starting to integrate and see the power of AI in helping to train therapists. So for example, there are AI systems that will mimic clients. So maybe even with certain specifications like this type of client with this type of issue in this type of mood, so that students can actually practice role-playing with these clients. And that can, of course, improve their skills. It can improve their confidence before they even begin to work with live clients. I have a colleague of mine at another university who is experimenting with AI with her students and improving diagnosing. And I think we've heard a lot about the effectiveness of AI in diagnosing medical conditions. And certainly feedback from an AI system in the way that Brian was talking about and pattern recognition, et cetera, could be helpful in supervising student work and improving their skills as a supplement to the live supervision that they received. But I will say student reactions have not all been positive.
Really?
So I could talk about that too.
Yeah. What's the reaction been from students?
Well, it's across the board, as you might expect,
sure.
But I know that there's some that have real hesitations about AI. What I hear is that, you know, they know it's here to stay, but the three, I would say, most significant concerns are about trust, which we talked about earlier. Can I trust? I can't always trust AI to be accurate. And some of what we're dealing with, of course, are life and death issues. The second concern I hear from students are about underlying biases in the training models that are used. So we work as therapists really hard to identify our own implicit biases when we're working with clients who are very different than ourselves. And we wouldn't want our own biases to be reinforced by an AI system. And then the third concern I hear most often, which we haven't talked about yet, is students who say, I care about the environment and the significant environmental impact that running these large systems can have on climate change. And I find those all very valid concerns.
So, Brian, let me ask you, bias in algorithms and concerns that while professionals are trained to eliminate or minimize their bias, that sometimes because of the data sets that are using, bias may be inherent in the artificial intelligence. How do you guard against that, or can you?
I am so glad Heather brought that up, because that is going to be one of the largest issues that come with AI in healthcare. And, you know, bias in data sets, there are some ways that you could go about it. You know, as I was mentioning earlier, we have really chosen to go down the route of evidence-based AI, where it is published. So in the instance of Limbic, their articles are actually in Nature Medicine, the British Medical Journal, where they have outlined what the demographic composition is of the data sets, what goes into the data set. There's also some machine learning techniques that you could do to prevent biases, but it's always an important consideration. And the other piece that we do is we actually have an AI kind of committee within our hospital that's made up of multiple different individuals from different disciplines, as well as a couple individuals that are totally lay on AI, where they're not experts. And when we are onboarding a new system, we get those different viewpoints to ensure that we're looking at it from multiple different angles to ensure that we reduce those biases.
Heather Hessel, where do you see the nexus of mental health and artificial intelligence going over the next decade?
Oh my goodness. I can't believe you asked me that question. That's a huge question.
Yes.
In 10 years. I mean, think about 10 years ago. I don't know that we would have expected to be here. I do think, so incrementally, I am training my students to be familiar with AI. I think it will absolutely get integrated into our electronic health record systems. That's happening. I think we should be open to learning more about using AI to improve our work as therapists. Just as an aside, and I'm not sure many people know this, but once a therapist gets licensed, they're no longer technically under supervision. They will be meeting with their clients in individual private sessions. You don't have a performance review from a supervisor, as an example. And even though we have to do continuing education, there's still this question of, are we really improving ourselves as therapists? So maybe this is aspirational, but what I'd like to see over the next decade is a real push towards helping therapists become better therapists through the use of AI.
And Brian, where do you see AI leading mental health care in the future?
I think similarly to Heather, you're going to see AI more embedded into the medical record. The other thing that I would also hope to see is AI primers, you know, being more integrated into clinical schools. So in medical school, or as people are going to get their social work license, I don't think our clinicians will ever be experts per se in AI, but I think AI literacy is going to be crucial over the next 10 years since it's going to be prominent. If people have the ability to evaluate what is a good algorithm, what is not a good algorithm, how do we ensure that the algorithm doesn't have bias is going to be critically important. You're going to see people who are really gung-ho about AI, and you're going to see people who are nervous about it. So we've got to find ways of ensuring that we could provide care in a safe environment to all groups of people, you know, regardless of what their stance is with AI.
Brian, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always exciting to share some of the things we have going on.
And Heather, thanks to you.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Heather Hessel is a licensed marriage and family therapist and assistant professor in the Department of Counseling, Rehabilitation, and Human Services at UW-Stout. Brian Kay is the chief strategy officer for Rogers Behavioral Health. Rogers is a business sponsor of WPR. They spoke to Lee Rayburn last week about artificial intelligence and mental health care.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, the gas station chain with the following: Buc-ee's is looking to enter Wisconsin. We talk with the DeForest Village president about construction delays.
90% of what I hear is, when are they coming? I mean, I don't go to the grocery store without someone saying, are they still coming? Is Buc-ee's coming?
Waiting for Buc-ee's, that's next on WPR News.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCullum with a story about taking care of our elders.
There are groups of people developing ways to improve life for nursing home residents. One particular researcher in Madison is focusing her work on the Hmong population in the Upper Midwest. WPR's Anna Marie Yanni talked with her about what motivates her to pursue this work.
Maisie Tao has a long-standing interest in what life is like for refugees long after they've resettled in a new place.
There's a lot of literature and a lot of investigation around what refugees need when they're being resettled, but there's not the question of how do refugees live in the U.S. And that's kind of where my work has been.
For Tao, this work is personal. The medical anthropologist is Hmong, an ethnic population from Southeast Asia. Many became refugees after the Vietnam War. And Tao was born in a refugee camp in Thailand. About a year later, her family resettled in Wisconsin. The state is home to one of the largest Hmong populations in the nation.
And so growing up as this child of this whole refugee experience, like I got to witness a lot of my parents' experiences through the healthcare system.
Experiences that she didn't see reflected in her readings in college.
And so I felt like I had to also insert my own story and insert a different perspective that allow us to kind of see how folks like Hmong Americans were also experiencing the healthcare system. So that, you know, I just knew that if I didn't do the work, no one was going to do it.
Now, Tao is an assistant professor of anthropology and Asian American studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She recently led a case study that showcased a poor quality of life for Hmong residents in a Minnesota nursing home. For 4 months, she observed life at the unnamed home and interviewed Hmong residents and staff. The findings were published in August 2024 in the Journal of Applied Gerontology.
There's talk about this sense of abandonment, right? In isolation, right? And for me, like, they experienced that in the refugee camps, right? And I don't want them to experience that in a nursing home in the U.S., right? And so how do we think through these stories that they have to really help improve our care?
Tao conducted all the resident interviews in Hmong. She heard that language barriers were hard for them in the facility.
When residents needed care, they weren't always able to access a Hmong person to ask for what they needed. And so there was a lot of where language then contributed to neglect or just waiting for when your next bath was going to be, right? And so a lot of the experience that the residents were telling me was feeling that, you know, white residents were being taken care of better than they were.
She also found residents did not have an appetite for the nursing home food. But there was more to it than that. Tao says food, and culturally sensitive food, is important to people's well-being. She recalls an interview with a Hmong staffer.
That was the most heartbreaking thing, is these staff members understand the limitations of nursing home care, especially for diverse residents. And, you know, he said that, you know, so he was a nurse and he said, you know, you have to bring food or else that person's not going to get better.
Tao said nursing homes don't need to go to researchers like her to learn how to improve their care. They can ask families.
So this stuff is also personal for me. Like my grandmother also was in a nursing home in Wisconsin. And like the most simple thing is, like, you know, families had to tell the nursing home, like, she doesn't drink cold water. She wasn't drinking water because they were giving her ice water. Right. Which I think, like, that's the thing, is that that's the culture that we institute in these places of care. But then she only drinks warm water or hot water. And so, you know, just asking family members, especially if the person doesn't speak the language, asking family members, what are things we could do to improve the care, would be so important.
Next, Tao is working on a research paper about culturally sensitive care. She hopes her work helps other refugee populations too.
WPR's Anna Marie Yanni brought us that story on improving care for nursing home residents. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Wisconsin Today.
The popular Texas-based gas station chain Buc-ee's is looking to open its first location in Wisconsin.
Not to be confused with UW-Madison's favorite badger with the same name, the Buc-ee we're talking about has a friendly beaver as its logo, and it's apparently a big deal in some states.
In northern Dane County, efforts to build Wisconsin's first Buc-ee's are running into funding roadblocks. Its highway exit will need upgrades for thousands of extra cars a day.
The DeForest Village Board is seeking ways to secure the Buc-ee's project, including asking state lawmakers for funding to improve that exit interchange.
Earlier this week, WPR's Lee Rayburn spoke with the president of the DeForest Village Board, Jane Cahill Wolfgram.
The Buc-ee's project in DeForest has been delayed since last summer after estimates found it would cost about $15 million to upgrade the local infrastructure to accommodate this site. Where does the funding on this project now stand, Jane?
Well, we have been working hard to put together a package for the funding. Buc-ee's has agreed to finance more than or provide funds for more than half of the cost, and they have agreed to finance the rest of it, but we are looking for reimbursement of the remaining portion.
we are approaching a couple of different strategies. We have asked the state to consider providing some funding. We are also looking at potential local TIF money as a one strategy.
Tax Incremental Financing District, TIF?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. Yep, that's correct. And we have a legislative agenda to expand the borders of the TIF for that consideration. And we're also talking to the county to see if they might help as well. While those sources are harder to pull together, we feel like it's an important thing for us to do and to put together this public-private partnership to fund what is an important upgrade to that exit in order to facilitate Buc-ee's and potentially other development that's going on west of the interstate in Forest.
So, Jane, take me inside of Buc-ee's. What's the Buc-ee's experience like, and what's it like if in the future you're pulling off County V and pulling into the Buc-ee's? What do you see and experience there?
Well, you will experience more than 100, I think it's 129, I'd have to pull up the sheet to look, gas pumps. You will find electric refueling stations. You will find a store that offers everything from a variety of food stations, which has been... they offer brisket that is nationally famous as being some of the best brisket you can get. They have walls of jerky and jam and, you know, other food products. They also have camping equipment and all sorts of things to make your trip more pleasurable. One of the executives once said to me, if you're going up north to camp, you could get everything you need to go camping right here. There are other kinds of souvenirs available, from coffee cups to, you know, the kinds of things you might expect to find locally. And they often are known for working with stores locally that offer products such as the local cheese shops. If you guys want to come and work with us, they will help to promote or to sell local product, because that's one of the fears by some of the local local people is that, well, they'll take all of our customers. Not true. The other thing that everyone tells me and I experience, they have some of the cleanest bathrooms you'll ever find when you're traveling. And they're big, and there are lots of stalls and lots of sinks. And they are truly very clean. And I think that's very important. And they pay their staff very well. You know, it is important to us that people get a living wage, and they offer a good pay rate, and they're known for treating their employees well, and that's important too.
We're talking about plans to build a DeForest-based Buc-ee's gas station with Jane Cahill-Wolfgram, president of the DeForest Village Board. And you mentioned a little bit about the community support for Buc-ee's project at this point. Where would you find that level right now, Jane?
Well, I hear from lots of people about Buc-ee's. And 90% of what I hear is, when are they coming? I mean, I don't go to the grocery store without someone saying, are they still coming? Is Buc-ee's coming? The few people that have contacted me with opposition are people who have misinformation or are concerned about bringing more traffic to DeForest. Fortunately, Buc-ee's is on the west side of the interstate. It's not bringing traffic into DeForest. People can get right off the interstate and into Buc-ee's. And a lot of those people were the people that are coming from Chicago, headed to the Dells, headed up north, headed, you know, way beyond DeForest. So, you know, they don't have a lot of reasons to come into DeForest. Although I will say there are many stores and other businesses who have said to us, we just want to know when Buc-ee's is coming because we're going to build.
Oh.
And they have plans to put up development around Buc-ee's. And so that's an exciting opportunity as well.
Jane, you mentioned that you had been, you've heard some misinformation from members of your community. What's the biggest misinformation that you've had to try to dispel there?
That Buc-ee's would be built on the backs of local taxpayers. It's just not true. We are not using general tax revenue to support Buc-ee's development. So that's a big misnomer. And I would say that's the biggest one that we've heard.
So, but you are asking the state legislature to include some funding in this next biannual budget. How receptive have you found lawmakers to the village's request, Jane?
I think we have found lawmakers to be more receptive than DOT. I think that remains the case. One of the things that a development such as this brings, whether you're going to add dollars from the state legislature or you are looking to, you're looking to fund it through TIF dollars. Mm-hmm. But for the development of Buc-ee's, there would not be the revenue that has been that will be provided that will actually pay back what is put out to support the development of this road. Also, the exit is part of, you know, the redevelopment of the interstate. And for a long time, this exit was on the list that the state was going to rebuild. You know, we have other exit ramps that are being redone. We've had lanes that are being added. And it's my observation that the DOT is saying, well, you have a private development that will do this, so we don't have to.
Huh.
And, you know, if in fact Buc-ee's wasn't willing to do more than 50% of this very expensive exit plan, the state eventually would have had to do the whole thing. So here's an opportunity for a public-private partnership to fund this exit.
Hey, Jane, thanks so much for joining us today.
I'm glad to have been here. Thanks for having me. And I look forward to Buc-ee's coming to visit us.
Jane Cahill-Wolfgram is president of the DeForest Village Board. She joined us for a look at efforts to bring a nationwide gas station chain into Wisconsin, and she spoke with Lee Rayburn last week.
It's a Super Bowl season here in Wisconsin. Oh, wait, I read that wrong. It's a superb owl season here in Wisconsin.
As reported by our colleagues here at WPR, parts of Wisconsin are seeing an eruption of owls that we don't always see in the state, including snowies, great gray owls, and boreal owls.
Birders around the state are checking off some rare sightings, and Minnesota Public Radio reports that bird fans are coming from around the country to spot these owls in the upper Midwest.
Bird experts say everyone is better off if you observe these owls from a distance.
Yeah, don't hassle them by getting up real close.
And if you have a sighting to report, let us know. Send a picture our way. If you have one, email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text us at 888-642-0232. Once again, that's 888-642-0232.
Plus, head over to WPR.org for more info on the owls. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.